Good day and welcome to Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich, and I'm very happy to welcome to our radio program Michael Joseph Roberto. Michael Joseph Roberto is a retired professor of history. He used to teach at North Carolina Agricultural and Technical State University in Greensboro, North Carolina. And he has written a book that we are going to be in conversation about. It's called The Coming of the American Behemoth, The Origins of Fascism in the United States, 1920 to 1940. He joins me via Skype. Michael Joseph Roberto, it's my very good pleasure to welcome you to this radio program.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Good to have you. It's good to have you. And when I first picked up your book, The American Behemoth, again, the subtitle, The Origins of Fascism in the United States from the 1920s to 1940, before I started reading through it, was expecting that I was going to read about Charles Lindbergh, Henry Ford, Father Coughlin, maybe the KKK, but not. I didn't, actually, not very much anyways. Instead, the argument that you and what you do with this book is you explore this question of whether U.S. capitalism contains the seed of fascism within it. And this one kind of took me by surprise a little bit, whether the New Deal during the Great Depression, the Great New Deal programs were fascist in themselves. Tell me why you took this approach.
Well, my approach is basically their approach. By there, I mean the sources for my book, who were writers in the 1930s, the mid-1930s, late-1930s, and into the early 1940s, who saw the driving force of fascism in the United States, not as different from the way fascism had developed in Italy and Germany. American fascism was being driven by big business, by the rule of the capitalist class. And they made very clear that the main fascist threat in the United States was something that would look very different from from what had happened in Europe. There would be no mass movement from below that would be the driving force, led by a dictator who railed at the ruling class and at the working class at the same time, in order to appeal to an essentially lower middle class base. And in both cases, but especially in the case of Germany, for that to proceed to the point where at an acute stage of the crisis in both cases, and especially in the case of Germany, the ruling class was won over to National Socialism, because there was no alternative except the communists. And this was not what fascism looked like in America.
Well, let's talk about what fascism is then. Let's dive into what I mean. It's a hard thing to define. You can find many different kinds of definitions. Some of them resemble each other, but differ in key ways as well. So how in fascism begins, a fascist political ideology begins with Benito Mussolini himself, that coins the term fascism. How do you define fascism in this conversation?
Well, I define fascism the same way that, again, my sources did, and they defined fascism as essentially the rule of big business. So for example, Roosevelt, in April of 1938, defines fascism in this way. He says, look at Europe and look at what's happened in Europe. Two simple truths are revealed by the events abroad. First, and this is a quote, the liberty of democracy is not safe if the people tolerate the growth of private power to a point where it becomes stronger than their democratic state itself. This, in its essence, is fascism. Ownership of government by an individual, by a group, or by any other private controlling power. The second The second simple truth is, quote, the liberty of a democracy is not safe if its business system does not provide employment and produce and distribute goods in such a way as to sustain an acceptable standard of living. For Roosevelt, the source of fascism in America was monopoly. And the structure of monopoly was the business system. And this is the same thing pretty much that a man named Robert Brady, who is an economic historian and who was not a Marxist, was a disciple of Thorstein Veblen, a kind of radical Republican with a small R. In other words, someone who believed that capitalism could work based on the technological progress within the system and what was being demonstrated and how to have democratic control over that. But Brady looked at the American business system and said, it's business as a system of power in itself that makes its quest to acquire more and more political power until it owns and controls the state. So Brady's in agreement with Roosevelt.
And what prompted FDR? What prompted FDR to say that? Why did he say that?
Well, there were people around him, Democrats and Republicans, like Harold Ickes, who was the Secretary of the Interior. I mean, he started calling out the ruling class and the American Liberty League, and yeah, in other words, all this large group of American businessmen who were the giants at the top, the DuPonts and the Morgans and who basically created the American Liberty League in August of 1934, and who argued that the New Deal was socialist. First they said the New Deal was fascist, and then they gave up on that, and then they said the New Deal was socialist. And so in the name of American business, in the name of competition, in the name of the American way, the Liberty League is basically saying that the Roosevelt administration is bringing socialism to America.
And what was the American Liberty League?
That was nuts.
We're going to get into that. But what was the American Liberty League?
It was put together by the DuPonts in August of 1934. And their concern was that the government was encroaching on their ability to make profits, to profit at greater and greater levels, because that's what drives the system, is profit at an exponential rate of growth. And they saw in the Roosevelt administration the promise to the common man and what the New Deal had brought. And even though the New Deal basically reinforced the power of big business, which is what I explain in my book, ideologically, that part of the ruling class in the U.S., the reactionary part led by the DuPonts and others like them, by finance, had the power to attack the progressive wing of the ruling class as people who were departing from free enterprise, and because free enterprise meant for them that they would go back to doing what they had done in the 1920s, which is to assume massive profit at the expense of the rest of society.
This is really interesting to me, because as you're saying this, it makes me even think about, and this gets to the confusion of what fascism even means anyways, and how we talk about fascism today.
Yes.
When you're talking
yes.
about the American Liberty League and the DuPonts at first accusing the New Deal of being socialist or fascist, and then accusing it of being socialist, it kind of makes me think about today, where we have people from the right like Dinesh D'Souza and others who are claiming is actually leftist activists today who are the fascists who are trying to shut down free speech for conservatives.
Well, yes, I mean there's no discourse that is historically grounded when it comes to the subject of American fascism from its origins to the present. And, you know, the third definition in 1938 that I think is really a powerful definition is it comes from two communists, A.B. McGill and Henry Stevens. Actually, Henry Stevens was someone else. It was a pen name that some other member of the CPUSA used. But anyway, McGill and Stevens in their book in 1938 called The Peril of Fascism said this. They said fascism is inherent in American monopoly capitalism, but it doesn't become a force of ominous proportion until the Wall Street crash in 1929, and then when the crash leads to a depression, that's when fascism becomes an ominous force, a more ominous force in American society. And my definition basically is their definition. It's also Roosevelt's definition. It's also Brady's definition, because they're all saying the same thing. But what's interesting about Magel and Stevens' definition, and I was thinking of this just before our discussion today, is that when they, in 1938, when they said fascism is inherent in American monopoly capitalism, they were saying that as two communists who were looking back not only into the 20s, but to the rise of the American empire. And what they saw in 1938 were the repressive mechanisms, the what I call in my book the terrorist fascist processes. What they did not see is something that we can see from the standpoint of the present, which is that there are also non-terrorist processes, if you define fascism as they did, as essentially the rule of finance capital. In other words, the rule of big business. When big business can commodify everything and subject not only society and its political institutions, but also the individual to capitalist imperatives through acquisitiveness, through accommodationism. These are fascist processes, and these you find in the 1920s.
I want to go back to the 20s, actually, yes. but to Italy and Mussolini's fascism, and the fascism that would come out of Italy with Mussolini. And the point that you're talking about is very true in Italy and with Mussolini about the combining of state power and corporate power. That's certainly a part, right, of how we saw. And that's what, I mean, one way I understood it was that basically Mussolini put the major heads of industries in charge of overseeing those industries.
Yeah, and we did the same thing when the Roosevelt administration created the National Recovery Administration after the National Recovery Act was passed by Congress. And then in coming up with its scheme of creating equilibrium in the economy by arriving at fixed prices and fixed prices on goods. In other words, developing codes for the commerce of commodities. The ability to set the prices was given to big business, because Roosevelt saved Wall Street and not Main Street. And that was, and in doing so, this is why people in 1934, 1935, who are writing about the threat of fascism, see that democracy in America is being crushed by the power of big business in ways that are becoming increasingly obvious to them, and so this is I think how to sort of like look at the New Deal as basically the Roosevelt administration deciding that we're not going down the socialist road, we're going to save capitalism. If we're going to save capitalism, we can talk about making it more democratic. But in order to save the system, we have to save the top of the system first. And so, Obama, isn't this what Obama did? So, after he got elected president, who did he save first? He saved Wall Street.
Yeah. This is Letters in Politics, and we are in conversation with historian Michael Roberto, author of the book, The Coming of the American Behemoth, The Origins of Fascism in the United States, 1920 to 1940. I certainly agree with you that Roosevelt and the New Deal saved capitalism. I think that's something that's widely accepted. I want to question a little bit, though, the notion that it didn't help Main Street. And let's begin with just unions themselves. The New Deal actually made unionizing and organizing and created the process of collective bargaining legal.
Well, I can try to answer the question this way. In the period that I'm looking at in this book, 1920 to 1940, the history of labor reveals the power of capital and its ability to struggle against it or to become subject to it. So, for example, in 1919, 1920, the war ends, and there is a temporary but steep decline in the U.S. economy because wartime profits are suddenly gone. Labor is put to the test with rising unemployment, and there are general strikes in 1919, 1920. The ruling class considers this a wave of Bolshevism. And to make a long story short, labor is pacified by 1922. It's also pacified with the complicity of the AFL, which was a limited, it was very limited in terms of what it actually represented. It didn't represent the new industrial workers in steel and auto and other industries that were on the rise. So labor then is complacent for the most part in the 20s. Then the Wall Street crash comes, and you get labor is active for sure, and there are major strikes, but it's the middle class, the lower middle class, that is really a kind of powerful sort of force here. In the early 1930s, 1932 and 1933, and it's according to one of my sources, who I think writes very credibly about it, it was the middle class, and especially the lower middle class, what we call the petty bourgeoisie, that was the driving force behind Roosevelt's election. So Roosevelt promises the common man, you know, a New Deal. The common man is taken to be everybody who's been hurt by the Depression. And then there's limited recovery. But in 1934, it's not enough. And so we see a militant wave of strikes in 1934. And then it's that power of labor that delivers the second New Deal in 1935. I doubt whether there would have been a second New Deal without the rising power of labor. But my point is here is that I think up until 1934, and especially in the 1920s, that labor, for all of its great sacrifices that it made at the beginning of the decade and then at the end of the decade in the South here, in the textile mills, for example, and in the plants up in the Midwest, labor had essentially been taken in by the power of capital. And when capital goes into a crisis as a result of the contradictions of a capitalist entity, which is massive and unprecedented, is the epicenter of the world system. It becomes the world's banker, the leading creditor nation in the world in the 1920s. I mean, this is the power of American capitalism on the rise. The behemoth is on the rise, but inherent in this capitalist modernization are the exacerbation of contradictions between capital and labor, which require state intervention on an unprecedented scale, and that's what the New Deal delivers. And in doing so, it saves capitalism, but in saving capitalism, it also strengthens fascist processes. So some of my sources in the mid-1930s, like these two writers who are writing for Harper's Magazine in June of 1934 in an essay called "Must America Go Fascist?" They basically argue that the U.S. economy, as a result of the New Deal, already resembles the corporatist state in Italy, and explains why. Because the so-called partnership isn't a partnership at all. It's capital over labor, and that's what fascism does. It makes it possible for fascism is the function of capitalism that makes capitalists turn to in a moment of crisis or in a steady march toward the increasing power of their class and their interests.
This is my understanding of fascism. And part of it agrees with what you are saying concerning the combining of the corporate world and the public sector. In other words, the state and major corporations. That's what you saw in fascist Italy, as we talked about. That's what you found in fascist Germany. But there's another part of it as well. It's very much sociological and cultural, and that being that the dominant culture, the majority culture, uses that dominant position to further solidify its domination in society by scapegoating a minority, which you also see in Italy, which you also see in Germany, which would eventually lead to the Holocaust. So in the United States, you certainly had fascist tendencies. I think of Henry Ford. I think of Charles Lindbergh. I think of the second coming of the Ku Klux Klan. But those were at the fringes. So it was much more marginal. And so I'm sure you must hear this a lot, in fact, when you tell people your idea of fascism in America during this period of time.
Well, let's go back to what you said before just a few minutes ago about identity. And yeah, we know that from 1920 to 1925, the Klan had 5 million members and more in the Midwest than in the South. And so the Klan, as Nancy McLean argued in her very fine book on the Second Klan, argued along with others rightly that although white supremacy would always be the basis of the Klan's ideology, the list now became more extensive. In other words, the enemies of 100% Americanism were the Catholics, the Jews, the Mexicans, the gays, all of this stuff. In other words, the Klan represented a reactionary, a very strong reactionary current in the U.S. in the first half of the 20s. And as McLean also argues in her book, the composition of the Klan was what she called middling men. In other words, the middle classes in the towns and cities across the South and in the Midwest. That's very powerful because the 100% Americanism was also what the ruling class capitalists were arguing. They were telling their people, you've been successful in business, so run for office and get elected at the state or local level and shrink government, because this is how you limit the power of labor. And the power of labor is also the power of the mob, and the power of the mob is the power of the blacks and of the Mexicans and other, in other words, of the undesirable. So 100% Americanism is an important part of the rise of American fascist ideology to the extent that it serves the ruling class interests. And that's the difference between understanding fascism in the U.S. and its genesis and the way it developed in Italy and Germany. One comes essentially from the ranks and the other comes from the top. But it has all of the essential features in the end, because in the end, fascism is the end game of monopoly finance capitalism.
The narrative,
You know, I mean, and I think probably many people will agree with this once they begin to wrap their heads around the process, which I think is essential to demystify the word fascism and to make it something that is not exotic. I mean, again, I go back to Henry Stevens and A.B. McGill, who said very clearly in 1938, every national form of fascism is different. What I think I try to do in my book is to build on what they're saying and say it's different because if fascism is a function of monopoly finance capitalism, then the level of capitalist development determines the form that fascism will take. And this is where the challenge of political economy and Marxist political economy, to the extent that I understand Marxist political economy, works in the service of history. So what I've done here in the book, I think, is to recover this lost discourse, which I think is essential to any student of American fascism, any student of contemporary U.S. history, but more importantly, any American citizen who wants to understand what the real threat is. And the real threat is not just Trump. It's the business system that now allows him to continue to function in the White House for the moment.
We are in conversation with historian Michael Roberto. He is the author of the book, The Coming of the American Behemoth, The Origins of Fascism in the United States, 1920 to 1940. That is what we are in conversation about. Michael Roberto, I want to continue on with my own understanding of fascism, and I'll give you every opportunity to respond and disagree however you like. But this is something that I always found funny, especially when you compare what's happening during the 1930s and even into the 1940s compared to fascist Italy and fascist Germany. And that is what happened to and the response during this time of veterans from the First World War, World War One, in Italy and Germany. Both Mussolini and Hitler rode on the backs of World War One veterans who were very disgruntled after coming back to the war, disgruntled that at least in Germany, that they lost the war, and also now having to deal with an economic crisis beyond what anyone could have imagined before. In the United States, we also had our disgruntled World War One veterans. In fact, sometimes we call them as a group the Bonus Army. And these were World War One veterans in 1932 who marched on to Washington, D.C., demanding their bonus for their service in the First Great War. And this is when Herbert Hoover is still in office. And the way that Herbert Hoover, the Republican president, responds to this Bonus Army is he actually sticks the United States Army out into the Washington Mall and the areas around Washington, D.C. to destroy this Bonus Army's encampments that they created around the Capitol. So there is a seed of some discontentment. You would think this would be a group of people that are ripe for a fascist movement here. After the election, and just at the very beginning of the Roosevelt administration, when FDR comes in, the Bonus Army, a smaller Bonus Army, but nonetheless, World War One veterans once again return to Washington, D.C., demanding their bonus, which, again, they're supposed to get later on, but they need it now because it's dire economic situation here in the country. And instead of greeting them with the military and, you know, sicking Douglas McCarthy after them the way that Herbert Hoover did, Franklin Roosevelt and Eleanor Roosevelt greeted them with sandwiches and coffee and did not give them their bonuses, but instead made them some of the first employees of the new government-backed programs and jobs programs and construction programs and infrastructure programs that the New Deal created. And I see that as a way of keeping fascism here in the United States at the margins.
Well, I think that you're right when it comes to Roosevelt thinking about what he was doing in his own mind. You know, it's the bonus marches. I mean, let me go back to what you were saying about the bonus marches, how they could have represented what developed in Germany with the Freikorps and the paramilitary groups. The bonus marchers were basically many of them were middle class men. They were industrial workers who had lost their jobs, or they were small merchants or whatever. And they came to Washington. They didn't come. They came peacefully. And it was interesting that it was Hoover and MacArthur who and the business people behind them who branded the bonus marchers as communists. And I mean, I have a section in my book on this. So I mean, the bonus marches were not that they came more as people, I think, who were asking for what they felt they deserved as soldiers, and in ways they were asking as workers. I mean, they were workers in uniform, and so there was nothing like that. Instead, it was the people who a few months later, actually it was during that time, there were people in the Republican Party in Congress who were calling for a dictatorship. So we need some kind of Mussolini, you know, and that's very real. So again, the odd thing is that in the fascist moment in the U.S., before Roosevelt gets elected, the driving force of fascism, again, is not coming from below. It's not coming from a middle class. In fact, it's what's happening is that the lower middle class gets behind Roosevelt in what is perhaps the last great hope on the part of the American class to believe in liberalism. You know, I mean, and of course, liberalism delivered. But Roosevelt's New Deal was basically, as the people, the most astute observers said in the 30s, was a bold experiment, and Roosevelt's bold experimentation was severely criticized by people who did not see the results that the New Deal had promised. And so, to answer your question, yes, Roosevelt is fighting fascism, but Roosevelt also doesn't quite realize that what he claims to be against, which is monopoly, has inherent fascist processes within it. And that gets us into a difficult discussion of where Roosevelt stands on this historic question of whether or not you can have a good capitalism by eliminating the bad capitalism. And this divide goes all the way back to Marx and Proudhon in the mid 19th century. And I mean, I've written a little bit about this, and I'd like to return to it once again at some point.
You're getting at the idea, though, that fascism is inherent. The seed of fascism is in capitalism itself. Is that the argument?
Yes. I mean, when we say that fascism is the rule of finance capital itself, deconstruct that concept and consider how many forms of control, manipulation, persuasion, coercion, as well as accommodationism comes in these myriad powers that capital has. I mean, this is what some people, like when Michael Yates in his book, which is, I think, a very fine book in which some people are now beginning to study in various parts of the country. I know there's a study group in Philadelphia, one in Brooklyn. There's a study group here in Greensboro this weekend. And what Michael says is that the working class can change the world, and we can do our part as working people by making a break with capital with as many levels as you as one possibly can. What does that mean? I mean, consider it. It means the way we live. It means the choices that we make in the marketplace, and whether or not we're conscious. How conscious are we of doing the things that we're doing? And if not, we remain subjected to the forces that have been created by the capitalist system, by the power of propaganda and public relations and advertising, and the role that psychology plays in all of this ever since the 1920s. All of these processes are aimed at the domination of capital over society, its institutions, and the consciousness of the individual. And that, I think, is central to all divisions within capitalist society. Within a capitalist totality, I think all divisions are subject to the centrality of the movement of capital, and how, given a capitalist production and exchange and its and the fundamental contradiction between capital and labor, that capitalism will resort to fascism in whatever form is desirable. And which means that particular national form.
Can you have capitalism? Can you be a capitalist state without being a fascist state?
No, I think it's. I think it becomes an ultra. I think it becomes an extreme cap. It becomes a capitalist dictatorship when capital controls and owns the political process and owns the state itself. I mean, wouldn't you agree that that ownership and control that. The democratic state by a private entity is what Roosevelt himself defined as fascism. In that respect, I'm no different from Roosevelt. The communists are no different from the liberals when it came to defining fascism, American-style fascism, in the 1930s. And what's remarkable is that we can't seem to establish that consensus today. And the reason for that, I think, is because all these earlier writers were buried by later historians,
and I'm going to ask you about
liberal historians,
right? And you write about that. I'm going to ask you about one particular person in a moment, Lewis Corey. So I want to know more about him. But I do want to follow up with this question, though. I imagine there are going to be people listening to this conversation and saying, "Well, wait a minute. If you know, I have a firm idea of what I think fascism is, and again, it is sort of this nebulous term, but we do think about what happened in Italy, what happened in Nazi Germany, and what we worry could happen and what Donald Trump would represent. And so is there a danger of saying that if, because most states today are capitalist states, that they are fascist states then too, because then what we're doing is we are taking away the line between what's acceptable and what could be really horrible down the line of something that looks like Nazi Germany or a fascist Italy?
Well, look, you could argue that one of the most tragic moments, if not the most tragic moment in contemporary world history, is the Holocaust. And that is the result of fascism. That was the face of fascism in the 1930s and the 1940s. But what we're saying here is we need to consider fascism in the context of capitalist development in the period of late capitalism, the period of capitalism that commences with the new imperialism of the 1880s, which corresponds to the movement of capital itself from the last of business enterprise into its monopoly finance form. And this is what Lenin argued. This is what Lenin argued. And so what happens? And I'm being terribly reductionist here, but as a result of inter-imperialist rivalry, you get an imperialist war in 1914. And as a result of the imperialist war, you get a revolution in Russia that represents the first socialist alternative to capitalism in history. What does the revolution create? The counter-revolution. What is the ultimate form of counter-revolution? Fascism. What is World War II about? It's a war on one level between liberal democracy and fascism, but it's also an international civil war between the right and the left. I learned this as a graduate student back in the 1970s at Boston College. I mean, we were pretty much clear on this, and I think we have forgotten this. So I don't. There's no way that I am minimizing the horror of fascism as it appeared in the world, within the world capitalist system, in the period after World War I up until its defeat in World War II. But this in no way negates the history of capitalist development itself, which shows to the world that capital necessarily moves in the same way that Marx said it moves. It moves more always and always toward concentration, toward monopoly. And that is the paradox of capitalist progress, that within a rising sea of – within an ever-expanding sea of plenty, you also get a rising sea of poverty and misery. And I think that we need to understand that even though fascism comes from Italy, and it comes – and the fascis comes from a bundle, a Latin word that, you know, resembles a bundle. Yes, that was the term that first emerged on the world scene. But then look at how Americans interpreted fascism when their own system went into crisis in the next decade. And then examine the relationship between the ruling class in the U.S. and Mussolini, which I do in my book, and it's extraordinary. The ruling class loved Mussolini, and we kept Mussolini's fascist dictatorship alive economically with grants and loans and other favors and things of that sort in the 1920s and into the 1930s because Italy was considered to be the most reliable partner for American power, expanding American power in Europe and in the Atlantic world. It's really amazing, you know, when you look at the world from this standpoint, Mitch, and not enough historians do.
I want to give you the opportunity here. Yeah.
I don't know, all I was able to do was to be fortunate enough to begin a study of American fascism with my friend and former colleague Greg Meyerson back in 2004, 2005, and 2006. We published an article on American fascism in 2006, and again a follow up in 2008, and so all I did was to take the first part of what we were doing and turn it into a study of my own, because that was the thing that was driving me. How did all this start? And it's amazing what I've learned. I've been humbled by what I've learned about American history, especially since as I say at the beginning of the book, I was not trained as an American historian.
We are down to our final 3 minutes, and you have referred to these writers from the 1930s, and there's one that you write a lot about in your book, The Coming of the American Behemoth, and that is Lewis Corey. And so in these final couple of minutes of ours, and maybe we could even do a whole show one day on Lewis Corey, but we're down to 3 minutes, but I would like to ask you who he was.
Lewis Corey was earlier Louis Freyna. He was a founding member of one of the first of two communist parties in the U.S., and he became a leader in the communist movement in the early 20s. And then he ran into difficulty with the party. Paul Buell has written a really good biography of Corey, and I can't remember all the details. But anyway, he was wrongly accused and driven out of the party, and he never had an education, a formal education, but he was an autodidact, and he was a brilliant guy, and he started to study Marxist economics, and he he got a job in New York with a publishing house, I think, doing something. And he started to write essays on economic analysis. And in 1934, he published this amazing book called The Decline of American Capitalism. And it was such an extraordinary book that even the Wall Street Journal reviewed it and said, this book is not to be ignored. Of course, we're not going to agree with his conclusions, but no one can read this book and not come away with an understanding of how the Depression occurred. And what Corey did in the book was to demonstrate how the crisis of the 1930s, the seeds of the crisis of the 30s was in the boom of the 20s. And so he wrote this amazing book. And he wrote it in 1934 at a time when he was basically saying that Nearism, in other words, the Roosevelt's move to save capitalism, was a move to further the development of state capitalism in the U.S. And if state capitalism went into crisis, then fascism would be the result of that. Unless, of course, there was a working class revolution, unless there was socialist revolution, because Corey was a communist. He wrote a brilliant book. I think the Decline of American Capitalism is a brilliant book. He wrote a second great book in 1935 called The Crisis of the Middle Class, and that's a really interesting read today, because the middle class then, Corey said, had to decide whether it was going to go with the interests of the vast majority or continue to be led by the capitalist class above. And so the middle class was at odds with itself. And it was Corey who said that fascism in America was possible if a rising movement from below then merged with the interests of finance capital above. That merger would represent the American fascism. And oddly enough, I think that's what we have now, Trump and Wall Street. I mean, it wasn't just the Republicans who benefited from tax reform. It's not just going to be the Republicans who benefit from Venezuelan oil. You know, I mean, these are all, this is this Corey was a great, great voice in the 30s. And then Arthur Schlesinger, in his work, in his volume In the Age of Roosevelt, The Politics of Upheaval, says, oh, Corey wrote this, piece of nonsense. It's trivial. It's redundant. It's whatever. It's not worth it. It's just nothing. And of course, this is the great Arthur Schlesinger. So you can imagine, you know. And Corey is just one of several people in the 1930s who wrote amazingly prescient stuff for us to read now and reflect, so we can know what we're up against, because only when we know what we're up against can we then fight against it. So Lewis Corey, definitely one of my heroes. Carmen Hyder, another. Robert Brady, another. Moritz Halgren. These are just... Plus, a lot of people wrote really good magazine articles, like this article I referred to, I think, earlier by these two writers, Must America Go Fascist? I mean, we're not anywhere near where we should be in terms of our ability to objectively analyze all of the forces at work, because I think this is a really dangerous moment. I have John Bellamy Foster, 2 years ago, came out with a book, Trump in the White House, A Fascist in the White House. There's no doubt in my mind that there's a fascist in the White House. To the extent that a fascist reordering is now proceeding and will continue to proceed unless halted, means that what is possible in the horizon is that American fascism comes in the same way all these writers in the 1930s said it would come. It would come in the name of the Constitution. It would come in the name of democracy. It would come in the name of 100% Americanism. That has not changed.
Wrapped in the flag, Michael Joseph Roberto has been our guest. He has just recently retired as a professor of history teaching at North Carolina Agricultural and Technical State University in Greensboro, North Carolina. And he has joined us for a conversation on his book, The Coming of the American Behemoth, The Origins of Fascism in the United States, 1920 to 1940. Michael Joseph Roberto, I found that very interesting, and I thank you greatly.
Thank you very much for having me. Take care.
And that does it for Letters and Politics. The show is produced by Deanna Martinez. Kirsten Thomas is our engineer. You can find archives of our previous shows online at kpfa.org. I'm Mitch Jezerich, and I thank you for listening.
Thoughts or feelings about Cuba? Let me alert you to a sizzling new book called Cuba Libre, Che, Fidel, Celia, and the Improbable Revolution That Changed World History. It was written by Tony Perrotet, who will be in Berkeley Thursday evening, May 2nd at the Hillside Club, 2286 Cedar Street. He'll provide a fresh, fascinating history of the scrappy band of young men and women, students, artists, even some gringos, who were guerrillas in Cuba's thrilling liberation movement, then startled the world by successfully forming a socialist government. Tony will be hosted by Steve Wasserman of Heyday Books. This KPFA benefit is wheelchair accessible. Tickets at brownpapertickets.com and indie bookstores. That's Thursday, May 2nd, 7:30 p.m.
You're listening to 94.1 KPFA and 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, and online worldwide at kpfa.org.